sure some of us can relate to that, trying to quiet my mind. So I was basically finding that huge swaths of time, I was identified with a sense of self that was either virtuous, like in some way thinking I was doing the right thing on my way to the right place, or else falling short a lot of the time too. But what I'm trying to communicate is so much of the time it was a self story of, with a kind of conceptual map of here now, but on my way to that and needing to do X, Y, and Z. One of the very first intro classes that I listened to, when I first got involved with Buddhism, I just left the ashram and so on, described a woman who lived in New York who told her travel agent she wanted to go to Nepal because she really wanted to go visit with the guru. And the travel agent said, why don't you just go to Miami like you usually do? No, she wanted to go to Nepal. So they booked this like real long flight over to India, and then, you know, the train across India. And when she got to the border, people that had heard of this guru said, you know, you can only say three words. And she said, I know, it's okay. So she gets on the jeep that's going up across the mountains, so it finally gets to right near where the encampment is. And again, she's met by devotees that feel important to let this elderly woman know three words is all you really can say. Didn't matter. So she's in line because the guru's in this tent. And she finally gets to the front of the line. And again, the attendants remind her. She knows. She walks in. And there's the guru in his saffron robes and his wispy beard. So she walks up to him and she looks him in the eye and she says, Sheldon, come home. Three words. Now, this was a great story for me because I had just taken off my garb. I had been wearing whites and a turban for 12 years. And there is something about the realness that we don't have to become someone else. We don't have to look different. That it's really who we are. But it took a much longer time to start sensing that we don't even have to have certain inner states that we think we're supposed to feel a certain way, be internally a certain way. I saw a cartoon, I've always loved this one, with fleas wandering in a forest of fur, wondering if there really is a dog, you know? So, in spiritual communities, this sense of a self that's not quite cooked and it's on its way to attaining something can get easily reinforced. It's in the language of a lot of the spiritual communities, a lot of the instructions, that we're in some way striving for certain states. And James talked about this last night, a kind of somberness and, you know, heaviness, and that there's ideas about a good meditation and how it's supposed to be. So there's still this sense we're supposed to get somewhere. We're supposed to progress through the jhanas and experience a something. And I can say for myself, I've shared with many who come to Wednesday night class that before I joined the ashram, the spiritual community, I was a very driven person and, you know, worked hard and played hard and was going for things and a lot of sense of not enough and always trying to compensate by in some way being good at things. So I joined the ashram and totally transplanted all that type A behavior into spiritual practice. So we would get up at 3:30 in the morning to meditate and do yoga. And I'd get up at 2:30, so I had a little extra time to really get revved and go. And I had a notion that it would take me about, you know, 5, 6, 7, 8 years to be enlightened, and that I was working really hard towards something. And so I would, and when I'd go to different spiritual teachers, and I'd ask them, you know, what else can I do? Because, you know, I wanted all the input I could to keep polishing and chiseling at this whatever. And to a T, they would just say, just relax. And I go, yeah, that's it. Just relax. And that would become my new sadhana, you know, my new practice. The truth is that we don't believe that we can just relax. If we're really honest, and I feel like it's an important inquiry, we have some self-story that says something's wrong. Whenever there's a sense of self, there's a sense that something's not right. Why is that? We intuit the truth. And so when we're in that story, we know we're not home. So we're not, it's not okay to relax because there's something wrong. There's a sense of something wrongness, which really interferes with joy, which really interferes with living each moment as if it's real life because we're on our way to the next. One of my favorite stories, some of you know this, but it's so fun, I'll share it. A new young monk arrives in the monastery and he's assigned to help other monks in copying the old canons and laws of the church by hand. He notices, however, that all the monks are copying from copies, not from the original manuscript. So the new monk goes to the abbot to question this, pointing out that if someone made even a small error in the first copy, it wouldn't be picked up. In fact, the error would be continued in all subsequent copies. And the abbot says, well, we've been copying from copies for centuries, but you have a good point. So he goes down to the dark caves underneath the monastery where the original manuscript's been held in a locked vault and hasn't been opened for hundreds of years. And hours go by and nobody sees the old abbot. Eventually, a young monk gets worried and goes downstairs to look for him. He sees him banging his head against the wall and crying uncontrollably. The young monk asks the old abbot, Father, Father, what's wrong? And in a choking voice, the old abbot replies, the word is celebrate, not celibate. So there can be some idea about how it's supposed to be, idea how we're supposed to be, and then if we notice, we're monitoring, we have an idea of how we're supposed to be, we don't match the idea in a given moment. It might be because there's physical pain or emotional pain. And then we're back in that selfing that thinks we're on our way somewhere else. And instead of taking refuge here, we take false refuge. So the Buddha basically offered what is a totally radical and profound teaching. And that is, we are never separate from true nature. We're never separate from awareness and love. Just the way waves aren't separate from an ocean. That the only real suffering is that we forget that. That our sense of being contracts. And this is something that we might conceptually understand, but it's revolutionary because it's rarely this living experience. It's hard for us to get it that this very human being with its hang-ups and its neurosis and obsessing and our wounds and our self-doubts, that essential wakefulness and love is really what we are. It's hard to trust that. So our sickness is homesickness. That we think our home or the truth is somewhere else, and that we feel that suffering, but we keep from that suffering looking somewhere else. You know, I heard a story about Sri Narsargadatta, who's a wonderful non-dual wisdom master. And he was asked how he became enlightened. And he said that my guru told me that I am the supreme source of all. My guru told me I'm the supreme source of all. I pondered that until I knew that it was true, until I became it. Then he added, I was lucky because I trusted what I was told. But as it happened, it took about 6 years that he was basically said, true nature, Buddha nature, loving presence is what you are. And he said, oh, okay. And he kind of kept checking it out, and realized that was the truth. So we might hear that message it's the Buddha's message, and it's really the message from all the wisdom traditions, that what we're seeking is what we are. That the love we seek, the peace, the silence, the freedom, it is what we are, and it's here. We might not totally trust it, but awareness is waking up through us. Awareness wants to realize itself. And if we're open to that possibility that it's here and it's what we are, it makes it easier to come home to that truth. This is really what we're exploring. In the Zen tradition, it's described as the backward step, this coming home to what's always and already here, that rather than trying to wake up, it's really a relaxing of the selfing, relaxing back into that openness and presence. So the inquiry that the Buddha had was really, how do we forget? In other words, how do we get imprisoned in a small self-identity? And how do we remember? And I'd like to just use some broad language that I find that helps me in kind of being with this forgetting and remembering. And begins with a sense that formless awareness, consciousness, manifests into forms, and that every successful organism, including us, has to maintain some sort of a boundary between inside and outside to protect against itself from the environment and to get what it needs from the environment. So in other words, awareness takes form, and then because it's the nature of awareness to become aware of itself, it becomes aware of itself by identifying with the form. So in other words, a child, this is developmental, a child, awareness is living through a child and might first identify with, I am this body, and I am this emotional body, I am these thoughts. So this is self-consciousness, that consciousness has identified itself with its creation. It's losing itself in its creation, temporarily. And when it loses itself, it's forgetting wholeness, essence. So, again, the metaphor, it's like the waves forgetting they are made of ocean. I always like the way Rumi puts it. He says, whatever comes into being gets lost in being, drunkenly forgetting its way back. So this is ignorance, ignoring the whole truth. And it's developmentally meant to happen, that we get identified with the body, with emotions, with thoughts. We get identified with these personalities. In ancient Greece, the word persona was the same as the word for mask. You know, in Greek theater, that the actors would look through these masks, and that was the persona. And they'd play out these dramas. And what I really love, in terms of just kind of an understanding of how we get lost, is that we get identified with the mask we're wearing. And developmentally, we have to develop a mask. It's part of, like, an ego structure. It's part of getting through. But we think we're that. And we forget we're the one awareness peering through. So we're all going around with kind of a shrunken sense of what we are. This personality, this reactivity, this body. And when our sense of identity has collected around something smaller, when we look out, that's what we see in others. We are seeing their mask. Make sense? When we're identified with ours, that's what we see. So we see the other's mask, we see their selfing strategies, the way they're protecting, the way they're covering over. Or we project our persona strategies onto them. We say, oh, my mask is like this, that mask must be like that. So we have a narrowed filter of who we see. We don't really see each other truly when we're feeling a lot of selfing. You know, that saying, when a pickpocket sees a saint, they see the saint's pocket. Yeah, that's a real common saying. It's that whatever we're caught up in, that's our filter, our selfing. Then we see the other through that narrow filter. And someone passed this one on to me recently. It's a selfing example of not seeing what is. An older woman in Miami sitting on a park bench. Very disheveled man in tattered clothing sits down next to her. And so she asks him, "So what's happening?" He goes, "Oh, I'm just out of prison. I was in for 25 years. "Oh, what were you in for?" "Murdering my wife." "So, you're single?" You have to forgive me. I just wanted to stick that in because I like that one. So we get narrowed. Our suffering is a shrunken sense of self. And to say that it's absolutely natural part of evolution, that this shrinking, creation, getting lost in the creation, identified with something smaller. And our suffering is when we stay arrested in the trance of the separate self. When we don't keep waking up. So the good news is awareness realizes the stuckness. In other words, awareness can see the identification. Awareness can see the clinging. Awareness can see the resisting. And so really we have this capacity to wake up out of the selfing because awareness recognizes it. The trick and the key is that there's certain flags. When we're very identified with the self story, one flag, dukkha, is a feeling of sense of the pain of separation. And another flavor of that is longing, which we all feel, which is this, it's almost like this impulse of awareness to realize itself. That longing is different than wanting. Wanting is the self trying to do some more selfing. Longing is this kind of very pure heart awareness that wants to realize and come home to itself. And whether it's the gateway of dukkha or the gateway of longing, if we pay attention, we can wake up back into who we are. This is a sweet story of a woman who was pregnant, and her young son asked her before she went to the hospital to deliver if when she got back, if he could spend a few minutes alone with the child right after birth. And she was, surprised about the request, but she said, sure. So she had the baby, and she got back from the hospital, and her son reminded her of the promise. And the parents were a little hesitant. They left the room, but they left the door open a crack and kind of listened in. And so the little boy goes to the cradle and he says to the newborn, "Please tell me about God. I've begun to forget." So awareness wants to realize itself through these body minds. And the signs, dukkha can be our sign, longing can be our sign. In a deep way, it's this sense of really wanting to know truth. We have this real deep interest. And interest is sometimes a good word for some people, but it's wanting to know what's true. We want to know what's real. And that's awareness wanting to realize itself. So the challenges that we encounter, and this is what we do here, is that we stay hooked into the selfing story. I'm a small self on my way there, and something's wrong, and I have to do this and that. It's the thoughts, it's the believing our thoughts that keep us caught in the trance. We believe our thoughts. It says Ajahn Buddhadasa, a great Thai teacher, was asked to describe this world, and his description was lost in thought. It's like we're living in this virtual reality, and one of the most amazing things about coming to retreat is the power of these practices to begin to shine a light on how much, how huge the swaths are that we're in some virtual reality. And when you can recognize thoughts, the very nature of recognition is that identification and believing starts dissolving. So we begin to notice, we begin to sense the difference, and this is really what it comes down to. We start to really notice the difference between being inside a thought and being here. And I know that everyone here, different degrees, is noticing that. Any idea we have is one step removed. It's an image, a soundbite, from the vividness, the mystery that's here. So we're beginning to get the knack of noticing, oh, thinking. And not fighting the thoughts, not trying to control the thoughts, but re-remembering, like reopening the senses. And there's such aliveness. And when we begin to sense how much we're lost, there's also a sorrow and a longing. Again, that's awareness kind of knocking at the door, because we sense how much we're missing out on here-ness. The mind is constantly trying to figure out what page it's on in the story of itself. Close the book. Burn the bookmark. End of story. Now the dancing begins. So here's the challenge. There's something in us that would really love to do that. To stop always trying to figure it out. Have you noticed how many moments we're kind of processing what's happening? And yet the challenge is that it's the primary false refuge. When we're afraid, when we're wanting, thinking is our tool to try to get what we want and basically to try to control our experience. So when there's any sense of selfness, hand in hand with selfness is this effort to control, to make the self okay. And we do it through thoughts. So the challenge is we believe them because they're on the way to what we want, we think. And the heart of the path and practice here is to notice that. Just to notice it and recognize what's happening. Begin to dissolve it some. I don't know if I can find what I want to find. This is Sri Nisargadatta. He says, the real world is beyond our thoughts and ideas. We see it through the net of our desires, divided into pleasure and pain, right and wrong, inner and outer. To see the universe as it is, you must step beyond the net. It is not hard to do so, for the net is full of holes. So as we practice here, there are two related pathways that we explore that help us wake up out of the story, beyond the net, to that space and awareness and heart that really is home, true home. And for the remainder of the talk, I'd like to describe these two totally related pathways that we explore here. It's going to be just hopefully a deepening of what you're already sensing is our practice. if there's anything that sounds really new, then we haven't been communicating well. The first pathway is full presence with the waves of our experience. That whatever is arising moment to moment, that there is a recognizing and full allowing of the life just as it is. So we're just letting everything be as it is, the different objects of awareness coming and going. The second pathway is recognizing the awareness that's recognizing. So it's recognizing the waves and letting them come and go, and then recognizing the ocean of awareness itself. And they're absolutely inseparable. So let's look at the first. Because if we want to say, I'm going to take my refuge in my true home, which is pure awareness, the abundance for which I long so greatly, and that I'm not a self, and I'm really this awareness. So let's say fear comes up, okay? And we say, okay, am I this fear? No, I'm not this fear. It doesn't work. Does it? I mean, have you been able to have strong fear come up and say, I'm not this fear, and then have it dissolve? Anybody? Maybe. But I shouldn't ask anybody, because who knows? My experience is when there's a lot of stickiness, a lot of identification, a lot of reactivity, that our practice of waking up means opening to the very thing we're fighting or resisting. That there's no way to experience the oceanness if there's any aversion to the waves. So much of our practice here is learning to not resist the waves. Swami Satchidananda many of you probably know of, a wonderful yoga teacher, yoga master. One of his students said, in order to do this yoga, do I have to be a Hindu? And he said, no, you just have to be an undo. And I like that, because this opening to the waves is really kind of undoing our resistance. It's like we're just recognizing and allowing what's there, but that means like undoing the pushing it away or the holding on. But it's not a doing. So an example of how opening to the waves wakes us up out of the self story that I'll share is a woman who came to retreat last year when I was up in Massachusetts, and she was right in the thick of a custody battle. And one of the first things she told me was, I'm here and I almost shouldn't be here. I feel like I'm fighting for my life, Tara. I'm just fighting for my life, and I'm scared not to be in the trenches fighting. And as she was meditating, she said, I'm at war, you know. And basically, she had images. She felt like historically she was not a violent person, but she had images of smashing her ex's face, you know, like with a rock kind of. I mean, really, she felt like she was fighting for her life. And so our work together was really opening to the ways of anger. And she said, you know, what I really feel like I need to do is take boulders and hurl them. And much like the questions in the hall this morning, you know, if there's an urge to laugh, there's an urge to cry. Well, similarly, I encouraged her to energetically do that, do whatever wanted to happen. Not manufacture, okay, but to open up and let the anger rip, you know, let it be all that it was energetically. And so, you know, she felt like it was kind of exploding through the room and the walls, and it was like firestorms across the East Coast, and New England was gone, and it was going out into the oceans and up into the galaxy, you know. So it was big. And really the only instructions in this kind of mutual meditation was just to keep noticing and allowing, not to resist in any way, not to control, just allow it. So it got very huge. And then she quieted some, but it was like this. And she said, I feel like a wire of iron is squeezing my heart and squeezing it smaller and smaller, and it's fear. And so she let that keep squeezing. And the belief, I'm going to lose everything I love. That was the fear. I'm going to lose everything I love, which in this case were her children. Again, to notice and open and allow, to allow, to allow, until it became this heart-wrenching grief. And then to keep on allowing. And she said, it's like, she said, I don't know whether I'm grieving what's about to come or what's already happened. It was the ocean of grief. And the more she allowed, the more she just became, as she described, she just said, it's just, there's so much space. There's so much space. And gradually, it was just compassionate space, being with this incredible pain of her humanity. This is the shift in identity, the awakening from the self story, where we open to the waves that are underneath the story until there's an arriving back in the very presence that is what we are. And there's a shift from being the victimized, plagued, violent self that needed to fight for her life to that space that was just awake tenderness, a kind of sea of wakefulness. This is David White. Those who will not slip beneath the still surface on the well of grief, turning downward through its black water to the place we cannot breathe, we'll never know the source from which we drink, the secret water, cold and clear, nor find in the darkness glimmering the small round coins thrown by those who wished for something else. So when we come to retreat and there's this willingness to just open to the waves, to allow what's here, one teacher that's very much inspired me, Ajahn Shanti, describes it as this jar that we're just opening the lid, and whatever is still unresolved, whatever is still the stickiness of small self, wants to be seen by awareness and released, and it just will unfold itself. And there's these layers unfolding, and it's kind of drawn to the light. It wants to be seen, to be freed, so we can really come home to the truth of what we are. Now, one of the big challenges is that if it's at all possible to close the jar and resist what's happening when it's painful, we will very quickly, like a reflex, do it. And I've always described it that in time with practice, there's less lag time, that we kind of remember and go, oh yeah, okay, be with this, be with this. But the reflex, when we feel unpleasantness, it's very physical. It's like a snail is poked and it goes like this. So we resist. And there's this chain reaction. And the more we've been hurt early on, the more that resistance is deeply wired in our neurology and biology to tighten. So it's not so easy to say, oh, open, be with. So it takes a tremendous amount of compassion for the fact of the conditioning to not open. I'll give you an example. Because there's this irony that when we're hurting, we try to control things. And then we hate ourselves for the way we try to control things. The more we're hurting, the more we tense. And it comes out in ways of obsessive thinking. It comes out in blaming. It comes out in self-absorption. And then we hate ourselves for the way we are, which of course creates more armoring and tightness. That's papancha, proliferation. So I watch that in myself in a way that's very, very helpful to me when I can catch it. I shared with you some about physical sickness, and that's been my biggest Dharma teacher. Wouldn't matter, though, whether it was physical or emotional, because what happens physical pain will arise or physical unpleasantness, and immediately with it comes fear, like, oh, something's wrong and out of control in this body. And then all the selfing strategies of how to deal with it. Oh, I should do this. Oh, no, I'm not going to be able to do that. This is going to go wrong. Maybe I should take such and such. I wonder if that that whole world of strategizing will come up. And then this anxious selfing, which becomes so clearly what's happening, I'll start really not liking the self. It's like not liking who I've shrunken into being, disappointed that, okay, physical pain, why can't there just be bare attention going twisting, stinging, heat, pressure? Why all this, selfing and self-absorption where I'm not then open and sensitive to others and not meeting my ideas of who I should be, right? So I turn on myself. If there's some grace in the moment or moments, I'll pause and realize that not only is there physical pain, but there's a whole trance of a self that I'm not liking. That the very ways I've tried to get away from physical pain have ended up contracting me, and that I don't like the contracted self. And if I can really stay, I'll sense how turning against myself in that way is separating me from love. Because in any moment that I turn on myself, or that any of us gets divided, where we don't like the selfing, we talk about the selfing a lot. And it's like, it's really cool to start noticing, oh, selfing's happening. But what we don't always notice is how much we don't like the selfing. That we think something's wrong with it. Like, I think there's something wrong when I contract against the physical pain and start figuring out how to take care of myself. It takes a tremendous self-compassion in the face of our conditioning. We all have conditioning to resist, to forget, to get competitive, to judge, to think something's wrong. Which is why this path really requires a deep commitment to pausing, and whether we actually put our hand on our heart or more energetically have this willingness to forgive and take care, that's what cuts through the conditioning of the selfing. If you just say, oh, who's afraid, or who's feeling this pain, or who's selfing, it won't do it. It takes compassion. Why? Because there's an armoring of aversion, and the compassion starts dissolving it. Now, when the waves are less sticky, when we're here and saying, well, there's not so much reactivity going on, then the inquiry of, okay, so what's happening, drops into a different place, a deeper place in a sense. I often ask myself, when it's quieter, am I dreaming? You can ask yourself that. Am I dreaming? And the inquiry shines a light on how often, even when it's quiet, there's still a sense of a self-dreaming, of a self that's having an experience, of a self that's guiding the meditation. Have you noticed the ghost self? But even when it's quiet, there's still some sense of somebody back there that things are happening to, or that's in some way directing the show. So this next part of the inquiry is to really see through that very subtle veil of a sense of someone's here that things are happening to. Someone's possessing this experience. So this gets us to the second pathway. How do we really turn to look at awareness itself? The practice, if we want to call it that, which is really awareness getting to realize itself, has an inquiry really of who's aware or what's aware. Jonathan referred to a couple of nights ago, where there's experience happening, and rather than paying attention to the ways of experience, oh, sound, sensation, breath, there's a kind of looking back and saying, ah, who's experiencing? What's experiencing? This self-inquiry is found in all the Buddhist traditions, Theravadan, Tibetan. It's really mindfulness directed towards awareness itself. So there's a shift from the waves to the ocean. We're kind of, in a way I think of it as we're looking into what's looking out. There's a phrase, the God you are looking for is the one who is looking. So we'll explore this in a moment in a short guided meditation. But just to say that this inquiry into what is aware is not time-wise always a match for all of us, and sometimes it's confusing, and it's really best done with a very light touch, with just an interest, just a curiosity. You can put it aside if it feels in some way like it's not the right time, but mostly experimental. So let's practice a little. Begin by relaxing. Any tension in the body is some level of not allowing. And just to notice and let that tension float in awareness gives it some space. Feel the sitting posture. Let the senses be awake. And take some moments to listen. Not just with your ears, but with your whole awareness. Sensing the sounds in the room, the feelings of the sounds. The space in the room. Listening to and feeling the space that's here. The kind of stretching. Listening to the silence. Notice the surface, the contact area between your skin and the outside of the body. Just listening to and feeling into that space. Right here. And now inside the to skin, listening to and feeling the sensations that are here. Listening to and feeling the whole moment. And inquiring, what is aware? What is listening? Not a mental inquiry, just to drop the question and look back. Who or what is listening? From the neck down, sensing what's true, letting go into what's true. If a thought arises, where did it come from? Where did it go to? Who's thinking? There might be a thought, I'm here, I'm thinking, I'm aware. Just notice who's aware of that. That voice, that sense. What do we realize when we look into awareness? Is there anything that can be found? Any center of a self? What is aware right now? To just glance back and then let go into the mystery, the not knowing. There's a Tibetan phrase that the true seeing, the supreme seeing, is the seeing of no thing. Wei Wu Wai puts it this way. He says, why are you unhappy? Because 99.9% of everything you do is for yourself, and there isn't one. So this practice of really looking back into who's looking. And then letting go, because there's nowhere to stand. There's nothing to find. this letting go into the mystery of presence itself. That's what's called the backward step, because we say, well, what's here? Or what's listening? Or who's aware? And we open to that, and there's nowhere else to step back into. That's it. If there's another sense of, I'm here, there's just a, oh, what's aware of that? Ah. So the description of nature, of true nature, of awareness, when it's described as empty, it's empty of any solid entity. There's no self-owning. There's no self things are happening to. There's a mass that we might be identified with. But the awareness that's peering through, the awareness that's listening right now, that's feeling, can't be confined or identified as a thing. But empty of self does not mean empty of life. It's like this empty, this sea of wakefulness is just knowing, knowing, knowing. Some of you might have noticed when you look back into awareness, there's just a knowing quality, cognizance. So the qualities of awareness are described as empty yet knowing, and those are not separable. It's empty knowing, cognizance. That in this moment, sounds are heard, sensations are felt. The mind's very nature is cognizance. So one pathway that we come to this sea of wakefulness is by the waves, by noticing moment to moment, allowing and discovering in that allowing that we are that ocean. Another is to look back and say, oh, what's aware? And discover the oceanness itself. Sri Narasargadatta puts it this way. He says, love says I'm everything. Wisdom says I'm nothing. And between the two, my life flows. That the more we wake up out of the selfing story, the more there's that emptiness, the more love naturally flows. It's the spontaneous expression of awareness. We're not confined by a self story. And the more the love flows, the more it's clear that there's not a self loving an other, there's just a sea of loving. There's a description of the spiritual path as realizing, getting these glimpses. And when we get these glimpses of what we are, there's a little bit of a shock because we realize it's always and already been here. This glimpse of, ah, it's awareness. So there's realizing, and then there's familiarizing, whereby we move through life and more the sense of that self-story is seen as a story, and there's a trusting, ah, what's really here is a wakefulness. An empty wakefulness. And then the third part is inhabiting, which means that through the day our words, our actions arise from that empty heart, that awake heart. That means that we move through the day as you have out walking on the grasses, and there's enough quietness, enough emptiness of self-story that you see the iris is blooming, and there's a sense of the sacred shining through. Or a feeling of the air, and it's just, you just feel that the divine is playing through forms. So there's a uniqueness that's cherished because it's empty. It's not owned by anything. It allows us with each other to embrace the imperfect expressions of form and see what's shining through. I wanted to share as part of closing a story that's written by a surgeon, and he says, I stand by the bed where a young woman lies, her face post-operative, her mouth twisted in palsy, clownish. A tiny twig of the facial nerve The one to the muscles on her mouth has been severed. She will be thus from now on. The surgeon I had followed with religious fervor the curve of her flesh. I promise you that. Nevertheless, to remove the tumor in her cheek, I had to cut the little nerve. Her young husband is in the room. He stands on the opposite side of the bed, and together they seem to dwell in the evening lamplight, isolated from me, private. Who are they, I ask myself, he and this wry mouth I have made, who gaze at and touch each other so generously? The young woman speaks. Will my mouth always be like this, she asks. Yes, I say, it will. It is because the nerve was cut. She nods and is silent, but the young man smiles. I like it, he says. It's kind of cute. All at once, I know who he is. I understand and I lower my gaze. One is not bold in an encounter with a god. And mindful, he bends to kiss her crooked mouth, and I so close I can see how he twists his own lips to accommodate to hers, to show her that their kiss still works. I remember that the gods appeared in ancient Greece as mortals, and I hold my breath and let the wonder in. When we realize the oceanness, we embrace these waves as they come and go. There's a preciousness to them, and yet there's not a sense of our life being confined or in reaction to them. The poet Mary Oliver writes this. She says, still, what I want in my life is to be willing to be dazzled, to cast aside the weight of facts, and maybe even to float a little above this difficult world. I want to believe I am looking into the white fire of a great mystery. I want to believe that the imperfections are nothing, that the light is everything, that it is more than the sum of each flawed blossom rising and fading, and I do. So what we've been really exploring tonight is, for me, the heart of the Dharma, which is that really our practice is to recognize, to realize what we are, to wake up out of the story of a limited self and to trust and live from that vastness and that beauty. And that our practice here gives us two pathways that really work together. One is just that simplicity. What's happening right here? Can we open to this? These sounds, these sensations. And then in that quieting, to really, with that interest and longing to know, look back, who is aware? And to let go into that mystery. We'll do a final, just a brief kind of reflection to close. And this reflection is based on some phrases from the Tibetan tradition that point us towards our true nature. So letting in this pause, the awareness be right here. Come home to what's right here. The first reflection is that this pure awareness, this loving presence, is closer than we can imagine. There's nothing out there There's nothing down the road. That what we long for is what we are. It's right here. This awareness, this moment. The second part of the reflection, that this luminosity of awareness, this empty wakefulness, is more profound than we can imagine. It's beyond any idea or notion. The third is that loving presence, the truth of our being, is easier than we think. It's the backward step, relaxing back into what is. And the final is that it's more wondrous, more amazing and beautiful than we can imagine. To be this presence, to be this awareness, is to live as a child of wonder. To move on this earth, stepping with reverence, beholding the sacred as it shines through each other in love. Rumi writes, "One matter, one energy, one light mind, endlessly emanating all things. One bright turning diamond, one. Ground yourself, strip yourself down to blind, loving silence. Stay there until you see you are gazing at the light with its own ageless eyes." We have not very much time for walking, but in this timeless, eternal existence, what's 15 minutes? Maybe we'll let it be a little bit longer because it's such a sweet night. Maybe we'll give an extra 5 minutes and then come back here for sitting and some chanting. Okay, thank you.
The teaching you have received has been freely offered. If you would like to contact the Insight Meditation Community of Washington to make a donation or to learn more about our programs, please visit our website at www.imcw.org.